Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. H. Bruce Franklin, a former Air Force navigator and intelligence officer turned progressive anti-war activist who was fired amid controversy by Stanford University and is now a renowned cultural historian and an emeritus professor at Rutgers University, invites us to engage in his life experience and analysis of post-World War II America in his new book called Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War. In it, he asks, how many people alive today have ever lived any part of their conscious lives in the United States of America at peace with the rest of the world? And he argues that, in effect, we have been at war continuously since World War II. His book is published by Rutgers University Press, and it brings Professor Franklin to our show now. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard.
Now, that long list of what you've been involved with is incomplete. Hasn't your scholarship also included science fiction, prison literature, and marine ecology?
Yes, it has.
Is there anything that ties them all together?
Well, I hope so. My field is American studies, which is interdisciplinary. We supposedly relate all these different things to each other, so we're not just looking at things in isolation. So I hope it all works.
How do people respond when you tell them you're that proposition that many people alive today have never lived any part of their conscious lives in a USA that was at peace with the rest of the world?
Yeah, people are dimly aware of that. I think we tend to try to deny reality. But one thing that strikes me is that every place I go, everybody I talk to, spend time with, I don't find any support for all these wars that we're involved in. And, praise about the deceased President Bush just glides over his role in creating what we now have, the Forever War.
Well, he's just one of the many participants you cite in this book.
Absolutely, but think about the dating. From the end of World War II in August 45 to 1990-91, the main purpose of our country seemed to be to stop the Soviet Union, to stop communism, to stop the communism taking over the world and so forth. And then, lo and behold, in 1991, it was all over. The Soviet Union didn't exist. We could now get our peace dividend. Instead of spending all our resources on so-called defense, we could spend it on education and health and the environment, infrastructure. And instead of that, lo and behold, we started a war that was supposedly ending all the other wars. Mm-hmm. It was George Bush who proclaimed in March 91, by God, we've finally kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. So what was he talking about? When the Vietnam War ended, everybody across the political spectrum said, no more Vietnam. This is a slogan. Richard Nixon even titled one of his books, No More Vietnam. No More Vietnam. What did we mean? No more wars that would not have the full support of the American people, and no more wars without some definite end that would come to these wars. So instead of that, what we got was the Forever War. 12 years after President Bush the First proclaimed, we finally kicked the Vietnam syndrome, his son, exactly 12 years later, was standing in front of that banner saying, mission accomplished, proclaiming that finally we'd won the war in Iraq. Where are we today?
And Afghanistan is the longest war we've ever been engaged in.
Yeah, well, it depends how you count, I guess. There are a lot of contenders for that.
Well, we'll get to that. Let's talk a bit about what this book is about. It's part memoir, part analysis of post-World War II America and the events that have led to the current state of conflicted global politics and what you call the forever war. So before we begin, let's define what you're calling the forever war.
The war, it's not a single war. It's a permanent state of war. We were fighting in different countries, in different places, different forms of combat, as a kind of new normal, in which there's no foreseeable end to this. It's ironic when you think about it. The shift that took place when we declared a war against terror. Well, that by definition is a war that can never end. And you know, I see this as someone as an ordinary American who lived through these various transitions that got us into this. And what I'm trying to do in the book is to get us out of this place. You enter a maze, you end up in a really bad place where we are, with a dysfunctional government and, you know, all the other bad things. To get out of that, you've got to figure out, well, how do we get into that? So you've got to retrace your route. Well, that's the history. But just laying out the history doesn't work. You have to understand the role of the individual in history, and that's what I'm trying to do in the book.
Hasn't this been a bipartisan effort?
It certainly has, and it's interesting that we have this bipartisan agreement made over the heads of the American people. We're asked about this issue and that issue. We get either party, you know, sends fundraising letters and say with a list of issues that you're supposed to be concerned about, but never the war peace issues.
Have you discussed the forever war in any of the 19 books and 300 or so professional articles you've written or edited previously, and also four films?
Yeah, well, certainly in the book War Stars, where I go all the way back to the 18th century, it's kind of major there. Also in Vietnam and other American fantasies, and of course in the book about the MIA issue,
which you include in this as well, and we'll get to Vietnam in a little while.
You know, the MIA issue is very interesting. Back to that moment in 91 when President Bush said, you know, by God, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome. The next year, he would lose his campaign for re-election because of the POW MIA issue, which had been concocted by Richard Nixon and Ross Perot. And Perot ran as a third-party candidate in 92 and siphoned off enough votes for Clinton to win and beat Bush. So Vietnam came back to bite him.
Now, you grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn. What was happening in the world at that time? Were you, your parents, or any of the people you knew interested in world politics?
Well, you know, I was a kid raised in World War II, and I was, you know, a typical American boy, building modern model war planes and so forth, you know, cheering our victories and so forth. And there's a key event in my life, which is kind of fulcrum in the book. On August 14th, 1945, VJ Day, I was crammed in the back of a pickup truck with a bunch of other kids. We're part of an impromptu motorcade in our section of Brooklyn, Friends Flatbush, and every place we went, everybody was pouring out and cheering and dancing and waving American flags. and we kids in the truck were screaming our hearts out, peace, peace. And we all believed, and the kids, yes, we all believed we were going to live in a peaceful world. America had no enemies. There was no threat to America. Well, as I document in detail in the book, the Cold War had already begun by Washington. The Korean War had already begun by Washington. And 10 days later, the Vietnam War was about to begin, again, by decisions made in Washington. You mentioned bipartisan. All these wars, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, the Cold War, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan, every one of these has been based on lies created by both of the two political parties. And the documentation of those lies compared to the true events is something that people need to understand in order to get out of the place that we're in. In some ways, it's that simple, because it's really complicated, too.
Now, you write that when you were 6 and 7, you would end your prayers with, "Dear God, please keep us out of the war." That was the war in World War II. Were you aware of the reasons for the conflict? Was this discussed in your community? Because Flatbush is quite different from the area I grew up in, Williamsburg, where I remember that at my nursery school, I could say that about one-third of the kids were red or pink diaper babies. So the whole sense of politics in South Williamsburg might have been quite different from what it was in Flatbush.
Well, you know, we all thought that what we were fighting against was militarism and fascism. And as I argue in this book, in Crash Course, we lost that war. We lost the war. The most obvious manifestation of the fact that we lost that war were the two bombs we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But our strategy.
We won the war. So when you say we lost the war, you mean on the larger scale?
No, I mean we lost the war because we lost the forces that we thought we were fighting actually won the war, and this is not an idiosyncratic opinion. The two great novels that came out of that war, Catch 22 by a bombardier, and Slaughterhouse 5 by American POW who was on the ground in the firebomb of Dresden, both came to the conclusion that militarism and fascism actually won the war.
Ironically, on VE Day, at that time my family was in Ozone Park, Queens, all the kids who were celebrating were the same kids who had hit me for being Jewish. So life is complicated in America then and remains complicated today. We weren't any – it was just a different kind of lack of innocence, I guess. I'm speaking with H. Bruce Franklin, who has written – a book called Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War. You went to the 1939 World's Fair in Flushing Meadows with your mother. You say you don't remember most of it, but you remember the world of tomorrow. You were 5 at the time. What do you remember?
Yeah, well, this is, of course, the wonderful future that Court of America was going to bring us. And I remember, you know, the robots. I remember the television set, and I remember most of all the vision that GM had created, the Futurata, the wonderful world dominated by automobiles of our future. I mean, some of that came true, but World War II had actually already begun. We were yelling peace on VJ Day, but, you know, right away, peace became a dirty word, and soon we were led to believe that the people who were asking for peace were communists or dupes or sympathizes or pinkos. This was a radical change of consciousness that took place very quickly, and certainly by 1948.
But ironically, didn't Dwight D. Eisenhower warn us against the military-industrial complex?
Yeah, his farewell speech after helping to build it to colossal dimensions.
You ask early in your book, where does a society's culture exist? What are you leading to with that question?
Well, it exists in the heads of the people who are members of that society. This is where culture really exists. I mean, it exists in the artifacts, you know, in all the cultural productions that you can see on a screen or pick up in a book, you know, things like that. But primarily, ultimately, exists inside your head. And this makes it very difficult sometimes to understand your own culture because it's all mired in the confusions and complications that exist in consciousness. So this is one reason that I cast this book in the form of a memoir as I trace the changes that came about in my consciousness induced by things I was supposed to believe and induced also by events that I participated in which contradicted what I was supposed to believe. And, you know, ultimately the event that kind of blasted away parts of my false consciousness was being hit by reality was my experience flying as a navigator and intelligence officer in the Strategic Air Command.
Now, what are some of the main influences on American culture today, and who are some of the main influencers on our culture today?
Are you talking about
Donald Trump, or is it a totally different part of our culture?
Well, I mean, Trump, you know, is certainly a major influence. There's no doubt about that. But primarily, he's a product of certain parts of American culture, and you know, you can't say American culture is this or that because American culture is now and always has been a clash of contradictions, and so the racism, the ethnocentrism, the nationalism that's in conflict with other forces that have been changing social reality. These you can keep tracing back all the way, you know, certainly to the 17th century.
Now, I want to go back because this, you tell the story going all the way back to your childhood. And the start of World War II is often recorded as September 1st, 1939, the day that Germany invaded Poland. But you suggest that it could be argued that other international events had transpired leading up to the war, which could also be considered the beginning of World War II.
Well, certainly, Italy's involvement in Ethiopia is pretty dramatic, but it's sort of overriding a lot of other things is the Japanese attempt to defeat the Soviet Union, which was a continuation of the war that we participated in, going all the way back to 1918, when Japanese, American, and European troops invaded, this is before the end of World War One, the Soviet Union. But the attempt by Japan to invade Mongolia and the Soviet Union and their defeat set the stage for the decision by the Japanese not to launched their major attack against the Soviet Union, but against the United States. So these things were already in process.
Now, that attempt to overthrow the brand new Soviet government is rarely discussed in history books. Why do you think that is?
Well, the answer to the question is pretty obvious, because if you examine that event, and then you would examine the events that took place just as World War II were ending, you see the continuation of a process, and you can see the falsehoods that have been made part of our culture that substitute for the real history. I think a really striking example where we can connect the dots is the war involving Korea. So ironically, North Korea said, okay, we'll get rid of our nuclear weapons if the United States declares we are not at war with North Korea. But every administration, and you're right, bipartisan, has said over and over again, no, we're not going to say that. We're not going to say we're not at war with you. Well, when did that war begin? That war actually began before VJ Day, which was August 14th, while we were all cheering peace, peace, peace. It began on the night of August 11th, 12th, when Washington made a decision, unknown to the American people, to grab half of Korea. This is when Dean Russ, who was a colonel in the Army, was given 40 minutes to figure out exactly how we would divide Korea.
And that was because Japan had pretty much kept Korea as a colony for quite a few years.
Right, but we didn't consult.
Instead of just liberating it, you're saying we engage in another kind of activity.
We weren't involved in liberating it. I mean, the Soviet army was already entering Korea, and part of their army were the Koreans who had fought against the Japanese. Korea, yes, had been colonized by Japan beginning in 1905 with the support of Teddy Roosevelt at the time. We did not consult the Koreans. We did not consult the Soviet Union or anybody else in making this decision that we would take half of Korea set up bases there, take somebody who was living in the United States, make him essentially dictator of this South Korea that we had created. I cite in the book a CIA document, which is extremely interesting, which people can access because it's archival, but it's online, which contrasts the government that existed in the North and the government in the South. This is 1948. In which the government in the North is a government supported by the people, meeting the needs of the people, and the government in the South is a government supported only by the rich landowners and the industrialists who had been the backbone supporting the Japanese occupation of Korea.
But the North was Kim Il-sung, who turned out to be a rather awful dictator. No?
Well, in fact, the dictatorship in the South was the one that was massacring people, not the government in the North. And you know, again, this is not opinion. It's all well substantiated. They massacred at least 100,000 people. This was an anti-colonial movement that was being suppressed in the South. I mean, that war did not begin in 1950. It began in 1945.
Well, let's back up a bit. Following the invasion of Poland, before the United States got involved in the war, before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, didn't President Roosevelt commission a committee to research the atomic bomb? How was the concept of atomic energy presented to the American public at that time?
Well, that's a major question. I deal with some in Crash Course, a little bit more in War Stories, because when that decision was made, the government made a decision also to suppress and to censor any mention of anything having to do with atomic energy, even though there had been hundreds of articles, both in popular publications and in scientific publications up to that date. So that was all forbidden. This was all conducted in secret. And, you know, take a larger picture of this. You know, our species is a very relatively new species. We haven't been around very long, but we claim to be the most intelligent species ever. We are, in fact, the only species that has been able to figure out the means of our own extermination and actually build it. And implement it. Now we can't figure out how to get rid of it. But the scientists who constructed those bombs believed they were doing it to prevent the forces that might actually use that weapon from using it. It was mainly Hitler's Germany. The belief was we would never use these weapons, but. The Nazis or fascists were capable of using it. So after Germany surrendered and it became clear that the United States might use it, 69 of those scientists wrote a petition to President Truman, which he never saw, predicting exactly what would happen. You know, they said, If you use this weapon in war, eventually the cities of the United States will be threatened with this weapon. So now we think it's normal to live under the threat of nuclear annihilation by these weapons that we have created.
And we're still perfecting delivery systems, despite the fact that I can't imagine anyone thinking that we would engage in a nuclear war.
Well, we've come very, very close to engaging in nuclear war. When I was in, we launched three times, and were recalled, you know, at the last moment. And you know, my chapter on that experience is called 13 Confessions of a Cold Warrior. And the most embarrassing and painful confession is that when I was participating in those missions, never, not for a second, did I ever ask myself, should I be doing this? And that's very frightening.
When you were with the Strategic Air Command?
Yes.
What do you remember about the announcement that the atomic bomb had been dropped in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and then on Nagasaki 3 days later?
We were jubilant.
You say you grew up in the victory culture of World War II America.
This is the victory of American technology and might. You know, we were drunk with power. We were drunk with victory, and that has persisted.
Now, you visited Hiroshima many years later. What did you find then?
Yeah, I was asked to give a talk at the university, which I gave, and at the end of the talk, a gentleman came up and. Offered to take Jane, my wife, now 62 years old, 62 years my wife, a tour of Hiroshima. He had been a schoolboy during the bomb, and he'd been sick, and was at home, which saved his life because there was a hill between his home and Ground Zero. So you know the confrontation with the actual fact, you know, going to the museum there, you know, intellectually I don't think it really added anything to what I knew, but psychologically and emotionally, it sure did.
When I was growing up, we would climb under our desks. In preparation for an atomic attack, as though that would protect us against radiation. Was that a form of propaganda, do you think?
Total propaganda. Because, well, first of all, being on your desk wouldn't protect you, but all that was to condition us to believe that the Soviet Union had a vast bomber fleet capable of annihilating the United States and ready to launch. One of the discoveries I made in the Strategic Air Command is that the Soviet Union had, at the time, zero bombers, no bombers. They had no ability to attack the United States with nuclear weapons. This is all false propaganda. I mean, this is very shocking to me. When I joined the the Air Force, I thought I was being part of the defense of America against the communist menace, against the threat of nuclear war from the Soviet Union, and so forth. So, you know, this was one way that reality burst through my web of false illusions.
You're listening.
And what we were doing was, I was in mid-air refueling, was refueling B-47s and B-52s that were engaged in two missions up to and over the border of the Soviet Union, espionage missions, which were top secret, and propagation missions, which were not. A flight of four B-52s refueled by our squadron penetrated the Soviet Union 300 miles as a provocation. You know, so these things ran counter to what I believed and what I was supposed to believe.
And then Gary Powers was shot down, and he was considered a traitor because he revealed what he was doing.
Well, and he also didn't take the suicide pill that he was supposed to take. But, you know, he didn't have to reveal anything because his plane had recorded images of all the sites that had been photographed by the plane.
This is
the Soviets had that, and they of course caught the Eisenhower administration in a bald-faced lie.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. You write that in the 1940s and 50s, anti-communism was as pervasive in America as the air we breathe. And in 1951, after you graduated from high school, you started a job at the Mayfair Photo Finishing Company. When did you learn that the company was run by leading members of the Communist Party in Brooklyn?
Yeah, well, this is a very interesting experience because I was an ardent anti-communist at the time. You know, I didn't have any doubts about that. And we were supposed to be on guard against, you know, communist menace. So it was, you know, bits and pieces. I went to get a malt and milk and a luncheonette a couple of doors away from the factory, and one of the two owners came and asked the guy behind the counter to give him something. He gave it to him. They didn't say a word, and I said to the guy behind the counter, "What was that?" "It's the Daily Worker." He said, "No." So I said, "Oh, this is," I realized, "Hey, I'm working for communists." You know, this was during the Korean War. It's a very interesting experience because I didn't understand any of the political context of the repression at the time and so forth.
But it didn't change your politics. In college, you went through Air Force ROTC training. So
yeah,
were you gung-ho?
It didn't change my politics, no.
But were you gung-ho? You
no,
returned
yeah,
to Mayfair?
Yeah. I mean, I was okay on social issues. You know, I was pretty liberal on social issues. But on war peace issues, you know, I was still an anti-communist and, you know, thinking that we were menaced by the Soviet Union in every way. And
your bosses, Murray and Ben, closed the plant when Paul Robeson was scheduled to perform in New York. Why?
Well, this is a command performance, so we went to that concert on Randall's Island, and it was, you know, thrilling to hear Robeson sing. I didn't realize that this was an anti-Korean War rally. The speeches were so bland that I didn't pick up on that at all. It just seemed to me they were just the usual cliches that you could hear at the Republican or Democratic convention. what I didn't understand was the repression of the period. It took me a long time to understand the event that I had participated in.
They spoke carefully because they were afraid of being called communists?
No, that wasn't it. It was it didn't fit my caricature in my mind of what communists were. But then it took my own participation as an activist. It took COINTELPRO, the FBI deciding that I had to be neutralized. Their document, arrests and many attempts at entrapment and so forth, to begin to understand the kind of repression that was going on in the 1950s.
When you served as an Air Force navigator and intelligence officer, what were your duties? And where did you serve?
Well, it was an Arctic squadron that their home base was in Bangor, Maine, and then we went TDY, temporary duty, further north. So mainly, as I mentioned, we were refueling bombers that were flying up to and over the Soviet borders. And in intelligence, I worked in a vault guarding all our top secret documents, and we were supposed to provide information, selective information, to the members of the squadron.
So did that access to classified information, did that lead you to change your opinions about American foreign policy over the time that you were in the Air Force?
Well, sure, because it was partly the access to those documents that made me realize that, in fact, the Soviet Union did not have any bombers capable of reaching the United States, which was pretty shocking.
When you resigned your commission with the Strategic Air Command in 1966, was it in protest against the Vietnam War?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And we haven't really talked about Vietnam.
Well, let's do it right now.
Yeah, right.
One widespread belief is that the anti-war movement forced the military to fight in Vietnam with one arm tied behind its back, and you refute this claim.
Yeah, well, what did we not do other than dropping atomic bombs? Ultimately, it was the resistance inside the Army, the Navy, and even in the Air Force, which forced the United States to capitulate and essentially surrender in the beginning of 73. But you really need to understand, let's go back to the beginning. Again, this the end of World War II and the beginning of the Vietnam War. The day that we were celebrating VJ Day on August 14th was the day that the Vietnamese launched the August Revolution and in 2 weeks overthrew Japanese occupation of Vietnam. And on September 1st, Ho Chi Minh read the Declaration of Independence of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in Hanoi to 500,000 people. And he began this. The official Declaration of Independence begins with our Declaration of Independence. And he was reading this. In the midst of this, two airplanes flew overhead. They were P-38 Lightnings. When the people looked up and recognized these were American planes, 500,000 people cheered like one person because they knew that the American people would support their independence. And they were right. If we had known about it, we would have.
They thought that the enemy, reasonably, was France, which had made Indochina a colony.
Right, and what they didn't know was that on August 22nd, Charles de Gaulle had gone to Washington, and President Truman had promised that we would support a French reinvasion of Vietnam and the rest of Indochina, that we would finance it, we would supply the equipment, and we would transport it with a fleet of 12 troop ships, which would be diverted from taking GIs home from France. Meanwhile, the British had landed, because those ships hadn't gotten there yet. They rearmed the Japanese that had been disarmed by the Vietnamese. The RAF and the remnants of the Japanese Air Force bombed and strafed the Vietnamese. So when those ships got to Saigon in the late fall of 45, who greeted them on the docks but rearmed, uniformed Japanese soldiers? There was a tower above the U.S. ships with machine guns manned by Japanese soldiers. And every single enlisted man, every single one, signed a petition denouncing imperialism, demanding to know why we were participating in the subjugation of the people of Vietnam. So, which proves that the people who were cheering were right. They were typical Americans who were outraged that we would be supporting the reinvasion of this country. And this is actually the beginning of the anti-war movement.
What are the perceptions that persist about the Vietnam War in the United States? Did you watch Ken Burns' documentaries on the subject?
Which had some, very good footage and so forth. They completely misrepresented the history, because when they began, and talking about the wonderful intentions of the people. So what we're supposed to believe is that South Vietnam was a country, which it wasn't. It was a democracy, and North Vietnam was an evil communist dictatorship which was invading South Vietnam, and that we, out of the goodness of our hearts, went to support the democratic nation of South Vietnam against the evil communist invaders, and that...
Didn't we prevent a war, a vote? There was supposed to be a plebiscite as to whether to unite the country or not?
Yeah, well, this is part of the agreement, the Geneva Accords, and the Geneva Accords specified over and over again that the 70s parallel was in no way to be construed as a national boundary. It was just a line to separate the French forces from the Vietnamese forces that had been fighting for independence. And by 18 months later, there was supposed to be an election supervised by three outside nations, a free election. And as President Eisenhower wrote in his own book, that every person he knew estimated that if there had been a free election, Ho Chi Minh would have gotten at least 80% of the vote, which is why we prevented an election from taking place.
Now,
so much for democracy.
You mentioned earlier that you've written about what you call the POW-MIA myth, also the spat-upon veteran myth. Was there absolutely no truth to either of those stories?
There was absolutely no truth. I mean, this is absolutely verifiable. I did write a whole book about this. There was not a single POW held against their will after the peace accord between the United States and Vietnam. There was one who remained because he had actually switched sides. A number of POWs asked to remain, the enlisted men wanted to remain, and the Vietnamese said, well, why would you stay here? Go home. So, this is one of the most outlandish and preposterous beliefs, and again, very much part of American culture.
I'm speaking to H. Bruce Franklin, whose latest book, this is your 20th, I think, is Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War, published by Rutgers University Press. So you became radicalized, joined the New Left, and you were working at Stanford University at the time and were actively involved in the anti-war protest groups. That ultimately led to your dismissal. What happened?
Well, I was fired for statements that I made. And the university released this, actually book-length thing justifying it. And they explained, this is a quote, word for word, rehabilitation is not a useful concept in this case, unquote. And then they went on to explain...
Rehabilitating you?
Yes, right. And they explained that rehabilitation was not a useful concept because, quote, Professor Franklin's perception of reality is too deeply held, unquote. So, you know, I was blacklisted and unemployed for 3 years. I was finally hired by Rutgers University in Newark. Rutgers is, of course, the state university of New Jersey. So New Jersey ended up paying me and giving me a named professorship for teaching what I was fired for saying at Stanford.
Well, what happened to the First Amendment? I always thought Stanford was a rather liberal university.
Well, you know, Stanford was involved up to its ears in the Vietnam War and, you know, the so-called military-industrial complex, you know, et cetera. So it was very vulnerable to being exposed for what it was, in part. And it's many things, you know. The history of Stanford as a university is very interesting itself. But that's a whole other.
You'll come back and talk about that sometime. Meanwhile, you describe the current state of American affairs as deeply divided and with a disillusioned populace led by a dysfunctional government and mired in unwinnable wars. What's the current cultural messaging that's perpetuating our forever war? And by the way, it's not just the United States. There are continuing wars all over the world. Syria, Russia and Ukraine, India and Pakistan.
Yeah, you know, the divide is obvious. We have a deeply divided nation, but what people don't ever focus on is that across the political spectrum, there's general agreement that the government does not represent the people. That in many ways the government is the enemy of the people. Now this is
it's not
very
the
new.
It's not the press that's the enemy of the people.
Well, that too. But the people have, you know, different parts of the press that are the enemy or the friend. But as far as the government, so, you know, here's something you can really put your finger on a time and a causation. So if you reel history back to 1954, University of Michigan every 2 years has a survey about American attitudes. And one of the questions they ask is, does the government represent the majority of American people, or does it represent a very small minority? And in 1954, 76% of the people believed that the government represented the people as a whole, and only a tiny minority thought that it represented a small minority. 20 years later, 74, that had switched almost exactly the opposite, which has persisted right up to the last one I looked at was 2012, where 73% of the American people believe that the government represents a small minority, not the majority of Americans. This is a real sea change in a culture and in attitudes. And how did it come about? It came about during the Vietnam War. It came about the exposure of the lies perpetrated by the government. You know, there's a wonderful moment in that movie, Hearts and Minds, the documentary that won the Academy Award, when Daniel Ellsberg goes through the lies of the first five administrations after World War II about Vietnam, and then he says, "It's a great tribute to the American people. that our leaders perceive that it's necessary to lie to us. But then he pauses and says, it's no tribute to us that it's been so easy.
Now, do you think that we can break the cycle of the forever war? Because it seems so firmly entrenched now.
I'm an optimist. I really think that it depends on people's belief, people's knowledge of history, and also people's awareness of the potential power of the people. Tremendous changes have been wrought when changes of consciousness have come about.
Do you think that the recent elections are a reflection of that?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think what's most encouraging is the participation of more young people, more women, more knowledge. Not just a bunch of empty slogans. I think it's a very hopeful sign. But I think it's deeper than that. I think the anti-war movement, the movement against the Vietnam War, never went away. In fact, with the Iraq War, there were actually demonstrations bigger against the Iraq War than the largest demonstrations we had against the Vietnam War.
Who are current leaders that you admire? Do you think that it's even possible for them to affect change?
You know, I think one of the hopeful signs, but it's also a weakness, is that it's not as though there are charismatic leaders out there that people are depending upon. This is very broad based. I mean, Bernie, of course, has inspired many people to reexamine their beliefs and what might be possible.
He just announced that he's willing to step aside if somebody else comes along who has a better chance of defeating Trump.
Yeah, whether Trump's going to be there in 2020 is another question.
Because of some of the issues that are popping up now in connection with the Mueller probe.
Yeah, and also because some of his actions may not be viewed favorably by some powerful forces that had, in fact, worked for his election. That remains to be seen. I'm optimistic, but it's also very scary because there are some very frightening parallels between what's happening culturally here and what's happened in Germany in the 30s. Although this is a much bigger, more diverse country and so forth, but this appeal to the most reactionary, the most venomous feelings and urges, the psychological urges of part of the population, that's scary.
The cover of your book features two photographs, one of Churchill, FDR, and Stalin on the top, and on the bottom, George W. Bush with some troops. You probably could have, if you wanted to give a real sense of what you've written about here, have stuck a lot of other photographs on that cover.
There are a lot of photographs in the book, and the photographs are a very important part of the book. Because I think the photographs bring a lot of the historical reality, which we're not supposed to know about, bring it to life.
And the book is Crash Course: From the Good War to the Forever War by H. Bruce Franklin, published by Rutgers University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to H. Bruce Franklin, to Kate Guan, who produced the segment, to Ken Gale, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Let It Locate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.